Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I am an assistant director of practice groups at the Federalist Society. We are honored to host today's discussion on the EPA and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' proposed final clarifying definition of waters of the United States, currently at the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs for review. We are grateful to be joined by Charles Yates and Darren Bax today. Mr. Yates is an attorney in Pacific Legal Foundation's Environment and Natural Resources Practice Group, and he was on the litigation team that represented Chantel and Michael Sackett before the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Baxt is the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. To learn more about today's speakers, I invite you to view their full biographies at fedsoc.org. Thank you for being with us today. Mr. Baxt, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Matthew. So for decades, what waters are regulated under the Clean Water Act has been an ongoing question. The Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the agencies responsible for implementing the Clean Water Act, have frequently sought to regulate waters that go well beyond what has been envisioned by Congress. The statute covers navigable waters, and this term is defined further in the statute as meaning the waters in the United States, including the territorial seas. So a lot of the focus revolves around the question of what does it mean for water to be a waters of the United States or WOTUS? And so that terminology WOTUS comes from that, waters of the United States. On May 25th, 2023, I believe I have that right, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Sackett versus EPA, finally provided some clear answers to this question. The Trump administration has a proposed WOTUS rule that's currently being reviewed by OIRA, as Matthew pointed out earlier. Our discussion today is going to focus on what is required for any WOTUS rule to be consistent with the Sackett case. So a good place to start our discussion is to get a brief overview of Sackett, and we'll get into a lot of the details of Sackett as we discuss what is required for any rule to be consistent with this important case. So Charles, very briefly, what is the key takeaways from Sackett, the brief overview?
Yeah, so I think the key takeaway is that Sackett set forth a clear standard for federal authority for EPA and the Army Corps to regulate under the Clean Water Act. And there's a little bit to unpack there, but what that really means, as you noted, the Clean Water Act, it creates a federal permitting scheme that regulates the discharge of pollutants into so-called navigable waters or waters of the United States, as you noted. Now, that permitting scheme is incredibly burdensome. It's arduous. And if you run afoul of it, you will find yourself facing potentially millions of dollars in penalties and maybe even criminal liability. Now, the key here is Clean Water Act was passed in 1972. As I noted, it grants authority to these federal agencies to implement a permitting regime for the discharge of pollutants into navigable waters. So far, so good. You have a grant of authority to some agencies from Congress to regulate in a certain way. But very soon after 1972, when the statute was passed, things really went off the rails pretty quickly, to the point where as the years went by, these agencies, Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers, they just continued to expand that definition. What is a navigable water or what is a water of the United States? So the sort of footprint of what they could regulate, they expanded that further and further to the point where they're regulating virtually every ditch, pond, puddle, or damp area of land in the entire United States. Now, that came to a head at various points before the Supreme Court, but it was given finality in the Sackett case. Now, briefly, the Sacketts, without going into too much detail, they're attempting to build a single-family home in Bonner County, Idaho, on a modest, small lot. They very quickly ran into trouble when officials from the Army Corps and the EPA accused them of, in their preliminary earth-moving activities, discharging pollutants into quote-unquote navigable waters. They were obviously confused by this. They had a dry lot that was residentially zoned in a residential subdivision. Where were the navigable waters? The point being, due to what I mentioned just before, the agencies had expanded what they consider to be a navigable water so far beyond any plausible understanding of that term that they were regulating sort of damp, soggy areas of the Sackett's Lot. Now, they litigated this issue for 15 years. They made their way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court simply said, no, federal government does not have authority to act essentially as a zoning administrator over this residential building project in Idaho. And to do that, what it said, this is kind of the key takeaway, it set forth a clear standard and a clear test for what is a navigable water or water of the United States. And it focused on the operative word in both of those phrases, which is a water. For the federal government to be able to regulate something as a water of the United States, it has to be a water to begin with. And it said water is something that you or I could look at, relatively permanent, continuously flowing body of water, like a stream, ocean, river, lake, or the like, something that you or I or the Sacketts could look at and say, hey, that's a water. The federal government may have an interest in that. The federal government, because the issue in the Sackett case involved wetlands or damp areas of their property, it also set forth a test for when wetlands can be regulated as waters. And we'll get into that during the course of the conversation, because there's some important points related to the wetlands test. And that's really often what's at issue here. But it set forth a clear standard for when wetlands can be regulated too. They must be indistinguishable from that quote unquote water that the federal government can otherwise regulate. It has to be something that you or I could look at and say, well, those wetlands appear to be part of that water. They're indistinguishable. They have a continuous surface connection. So it's a bit long-winded. They give some background on the Sackett case and what was at issue in the case. But the point being, there's now a clear standard. This is an issue that has roiled the agencies, the regulated public, farmers, ranchers, people involved in productive land use activity for 50 years. And the Supreme Court has set forth a standard for what the federal government can and cannot do.
So, I mean, you've kind of answered this, I think, but just regardless of the law or whatever, just kind of why should just the average person even care about this issue? Why is this important?
Yeah, well, there's maybe, let me say, three reasons, the top line reasons why this is particularly important. The first one relates to what the federal government is regulating, right? So we talk about, again, this regulatory scheme, discharge of pollutants into so-called navigable waters. Now, the federal government, in addition to interpreting what is a navigable water incredibly broadly, has interpreted what is the discharge of a pollutant incredibly broadly. So it involves, you know, typically when you think about the discharge of a pollutant, you think of maybe some type of large industrial facility putting out some type of liquid waste into a nearby river. EPA and the Army Corps think about things far more broadly than that, to the point where they're regulating just regular dredge and fill material, materials that sit in place, stuff like dirt, rock, sand, to the point where, I mean, there's been incidents, cases I've been involved in where landowners have been prosecuted or threatened under this statute for, say, a farmer plowing a field. That's how broadly they interpret what is the discharge of a pollutant. So that's the first reason. And I think that to sum that up, this isn't just about the discharge of pollutants in the truly traditional sense, right? It involves regular land use activity like farming, ranching, preparing an area for home building. It's the first reason why the regulated public should care about this. Second reason, if they say you have a navigable water on your property and the activity that you're seeking to perform would be the discharge of a pollutant, which could, again, just be, you know, plowing a field to plant grain, you have to go and get a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers to conduct that activity. Those permits are incredibly expensive. There hasn't been a lot of studies done on this in recent years, but there's a 2002 study which compiled a lot of data and sort of averaged out what the average cost of seeking one of these permits is. And in 2002 dollars, that was $270,000. So very broad activities regulated. If you want to do them, you have to go and get a permit, which 25 years ago would have cost you $250,000. First two reasons why the regulated public should care about this. Final reason, and this one's a real kicker, if you don't do that, right, if the federal government makes this attenuated claim over your property and your activity, you don't have $270,000 to fork out, or perhaps even more innocently, you simply had no way of knowing what you were doing was regulated because the average person wouldn't consider, say, plowing a field to be an activity that's regulated by the federal government. Well, then you can go to prison or you can be fined potentially millions of dollars for the most innocent of activities. And adding on to that, the real key here is this is in many respects a strict liability statute, meaning that you didn't have to have specific knowledge of what you were doing was violating the law, right? If you did it, you're on the hook for these penalties, and you could go to prison for inadvertently disturbing a quote-unquote navigable water while plowing a field. So to sum that up, we have an incredibly draconian and expensive legal regime here, and it's administered in such a way that the average person could not possibly know what they are doing is regulated by the federal government. So you have a fundamental rule of law problem there, right? People are finding themselves, over the years I've represented them, there's countless examples, people involved in the most innocent, ordinary, quintessentially ordinary land use activities. Look at what the Sacketts were doing. They were trying to build a home on a residentially zoned property, and they found themselves in the crosshairs of two federal agencies. So I think that's a real reason why the people should care about what's going on here and why it's really important that the Sackett decision was issued to begin with, and that now these federal agencies buckle up and actually implement that decision as Congress and the Supreme Court intended them to.
That's great summary. And I don't think we can emphasize enough the fact that a discharge of a pollutant does not mean what we would normally think of. It doesn't mean by dumping toxic waste into pristine waters. It's really dirt moving activities. So it's unfortunate the statute uses the language it does in some ways, because it really kind of, I think people get misled as to what's actually going on here. And really a lot of the big major cases the Supreme Court has dealt with really have been kind of the Sackett type of property owners, usually innocent, in quote, innocent property owners. People you wouldn't necessarily know that you'd be violating the law. And we want people to be able to build houses. We want people to be able to farm their land. So it's pretty, obviously, not just detrimental to the property owners, but really for all those people that kind of benefit from like the activities like farming and ranching as well.
That's a very important point, Darren, that I think should be underscored is, you have these fundamental fairness problems in how this is implemented. But it is important to zoom out and look at the effect of this on the American economy. And it's extraordinary, right? If farmers, ranchers, landowners have to go to the federal government to seek permits to produce food, then we have a real problem.
So you talked about, and we, the issue about wetlands being kind of a central question in the Sackett case, which of course it is. So can you tell me, when are wetlands considered to be waters of the United States, if they are? And what are some critical points that you think the EPA and CORE, like two critical points you think the EPA and CORE need to keep in mind as they propose this rule?
Yes. So the question of wetlands is important because that's really what was at issue in Sackett, and that's often what's at issue in these cases when you're talking about dredge and fill material. So the Clean Water Act, it doesn't provide the agencies with any authority to regulate wetlands in and of themselves. If you look at the definition of navigable waters in the definition section of the Clean Water Act, it doesn't mention wetlands. Now, for many, many years, the agencies regulated wetlands as if they were a sort of standalone category of quote-unquote water that they could just regulate in and of themselves. Now, Sackett really cleared that up. And the way that Sackett cleared this up originates in an earlier decision called Rapanos versus United States. It essentially adopted the test from that case, or from Justice Scalia's plurality opinion in that case. But in terms of wetlands regulation, what the Rapanos court and what Sackett recognized is that, top line, Clean Water Act regulates waters. Wetlands are not waters, therefore they're presumptively outside the scope of the Clean Water Act. They're wetlands, not waters. The Supreme Court and Sackett also recognize a sort of subsidiary issue to that, however, that oftentimes wetlands, they often border or are very close to a truly regulated water. And there's often a line drawing problem in terms of when that water, say, ends and the wetland begins. And sort of illustrate that point. You think about a stream or a river. You stand in the middle of that river or swim out there, start swimming towards the shore, right? At a certain point, the bed of the river is going to become shallower and shallower. At a certain point, you're going to be able to put your feet down on the bed of the river and start walking, wading. You're going to walk, wade. At a certain point, the river's kind of going to give way and you may be in a marshy area, and then you're going to be on dry land. Now, it's often difficult to determine, if you're performing that activity, where exactly the river ended and the land began. You've got these sort of marshy areas, these shallow areas where there's water, but it's not quite a river, wetlands. So the Supreme Court in Sackett recognized that this could be an issue. There's a line drawing problem here. So the Supreme Court set forth a test that, sure, some wetlands can be regulated, but only incidentally to the regulation of those true waters. So in order for a wetland to be regulated, it has to be that kind of scenario I just described. It has to be a situation where you really can't determine where the water ended and the wetland began. So the Supreme Court effectuated this through a test. For a wetland to be regulated under the Clean Water Act, it has to have a continuous surface connection to the water, and it has to be indistinguishable, such that the wetland is truly part of that covered water, such that, you know, to sort of put it in simpler terms, it has to be something that, say, you or I, Darren, could look at and say, well, I can't really tell where the river ends and the wetland begins. So, okay, the federal government can incidentally regulate that very narrow class of wetlands that are directly having a surface connection or indistinguishable from the true water. And that's the really important thing to note. Again, so much of the error in how the Clean Water Act has been implemented by EPA and the Army Corps has been in their assumption that they can just regulate wetlands in and of themselves. You know, they've taken the position that wetlands are important for water quality, for various ecological reasons. So they can regulate wetlands, you know, potentially miles and miles from any covered water. And the Supreme Court simply said, no, you cannot. You don't have authority to regulate wetlands except in this very narrow circumstance.
So, you know, one of the questions in the is for the Biden rule, and I think even maybe asked by the agencies previously, is does it need to be a continuous surface water connection? I mean, to me, the idea that it wouldn't be a continuous surface water connection makes no sense, because if it's not a water connection, then you could probably tell the difference between where the water ends and the wetland begins, or other way around. So just wanted to get your take on the water connection part of it.
Yes, I think it's clear and unambiguous in the Sackett opinion that it has to be a water connection, because as you note, if there's no water connection, you can probably distinguish the wetland from the water. And Sackett made this point a few times in terms of how it was determining when wetlands and waters are covered. It clearly implied at various points in the decision that there has to be a water connection, otherwise it wouldn't be regulated.
I mean, if you can in any way, like there's a demarcation of any kind, that's it. That, you know, it seems like there's this effort to try to like say, well, this is next to it. And yeah, maybe there's this demarcation or whatever, or some, but there's just this effort to continuously want to bring in these wetlands, even when you really could tell the difference. And it seems like that's still an ongoing challenge, at least as I looked at there was a Biden rule before, we don't need to get into it, and the conforming amendments that they came up with. But really, I don't think they kind of bought into this idea that there needs to be this water connection issue. And if there's a demarcation, well, then you got demarcation, end of discussion. The wetlands are not regulated at that point. Just want to get your take on that.
So that's precisely correct, Darren. The Biden administration, prior administrations, and the agencies have explicitly rejected the argument that they have to prove a continuous surface water connection. I've been involved in four or five lawsuits since the Sackett decision came out, and that's really been a key point of contention, is the agencies have been dead set in their view, no, just a continuous surface connection, physical abutment, as long as the wetland sort of borders the water, we can continue to regulate it. There doesn't have to be a surface water connection. Indistinguishability is sort of beside the point. It's a question of pure geographic physical abutment. And that's a real problem, because it completely undercuts the message of the Sackett opinion and the holding of the Sackett decision that wetlands have to be indistinguishable from covered waters in order to be regulated. And, you know, I'd like to make a point on this because this taps into a broader issue, right? We're talking specifically about the wetlands test here, right? And the way the agencies after the Sackett decision continued to just sort of double down and refuse to implement what is sort of a key provision of that holding. This is something we've seen time and time again. This is not new, right? As I sort of noted earlier in our discussion, this issue, the issue of, you know, waters of the United States and what can and cannot be regulated, it's been to the Supreme Court a few times. First in 1985, then again in 2001, then in 2006 in that Rapanos decision, and then finally in the Sackett decision. Now, in those 2001 and 2006 decisions, the agencies lost, right? A majority of the Supreme Court in both of those cases said, no, what you're doing is illegal. It's expanding the scope of your authority beyond what Congress intended, and you need to stop. Now, those two decisions, due to various reasons, they didn't set forth that in the same sort of clear terms that Sackett did. It wasn't so definitive, but it was pretty clear. You know, they lost. A majority of the Supreme Court ruled against them twice. Now, after both of those decisions, the agencies went back to the drawing board. They completely disregarded the decision, and they continued to ratchet up their own authority and regulate as if nothing had happened. It was almost like they went back and started trying to exploit loopholes in those decisions or unanswered questions, and continued this sort of just steady trajectory of more and more regulation over private property. So this is a clear pattern of conduct from these agencies, and regrettably, we're seeing it again after Sackett. Before the ink was even dry on the Sackett decision, they were already back at the drawing board. They were writing new regulations. They were arguing with us in court over, oh, well, we don't need to stop regulating isolated wetlands if there's no surface water connection. They just continued ratcheting up their own authority. And this is the real issue here. I think this is the core of this problem. What's so relevant to the Trump administration's rule is this kind of recalcitrance needs to end, right? We've been doing this for decades. The agencies have repeatedly just flagrantly violated the commands of the highest court in the country. And that just needs to stop. And that's really what I'm hopeful that the Trump administration is going to publish a rule that clearly and uncontroversially sets forth the requirements that were given to those agencies by the Sackett decision. And this can just end. They finally listen to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, the past hasn't shown that the agencies will do that. So hopefully this will be different this time. And even now, I mean, I'm a little bit of a tangent, but even now, my understanding is there are some cases right now that PLF is dealing with where the court or the agencies still are kind of going beyond what Sackett even allows. You're still dealing with these problems, right?
That's right. Yeah, we've litigated three cases in federal court, an additional two cases before the agencies. Since Sackett was issued. And in each of those cases, we're dealing with circumstances where EPA or the Army Corps has asserted authority over a wetland or a small creek that clearly they can no longer regulate after Sackett. I mean, some of the facts of these cases are just truly egregious. I'll give you an example. I mean, this is probably the best example. I mean, all of the examples, that they demonstrate this trend. But I recently filed an appeal before the United States Army Corps of Engineers. So going back to that expensive process, as part of that permitting process, you have to go and seek an opinion from the Army Corps about whether or not your property is jurisdictional before you can even do anything. This is called an approved jurisdictional determination. They're very costly to get. That's the preliminary thing before you can even sort of get into this process. First step, you have to go out, hire a consultant, spend a bunch of money, and have a quote-unquote approved jurisdictional determination produced, which sort of delineates regulated areas on your property. So I'm representing a couple from Idaho. We'll get into that in a second. Caleb and Rebecca Link. They own a small lot in Idaho. They had a positive approved jurisdictional determination issued, asserting authority over alleged wetlands on their property. And I'm involved in an appeal before the Army Corps saying, no, that's not right under Sackett. But I mean, this case, it's truly the most egregious example of agency recalcitrance you might ever see for a couple of reasons. First, I mentioned that this couple, the Lynx, they live in Idaho. Not only do they live in Idaho, their property is in Bonner County, Idaho, the very same county in which the Sacketts lot is located. It's not far away at all. Now, if you look at the record for this approved jurisdictional determination, it's virtually indistinguishable from the facts in Sackett. I mean, the agency is asserting authority over isolated wetlands on a property that's separated from a larger wetland area by a road, which then eventually feeds into a large lake via an attenuated chain of streams and tributaries. I mean, it is Sackett. The facts on the ground are virtually identical, as they would be, because it's in the same county. So the hydrology of that area is the same. The agencies have said, no, we have authority over your property. You need a permit from us if you want to do anything. And we're fighting them over that. But I think that just really underscores how egregious this recalcitrance is. It's not just that they've gone back to the drawing board and tried to work out, you know, other ways to continue regulating. They're doing that in the same county where the Supreme Court just entered a unanimous judgment against them for their prior conduct. And, you know, there's a few issues in this case that are interesting that demonstrate how the Army Corps has gone about doing that, in that they're not their theory of regulation. So I mentioned the facts are identical to Sackett. The theory of regulation is not quite the same. They've gone back to the drawing board and they've come up with what they're calling a wetlands complex theory, where they think they can just lump huge areas of wetlands together, notwithstanding the fact that those wetlands might have roads and all kinds of things, berms transecting them. They think they can lump all of these together, call it one wetland, and if one inch of that large, you know, could be 1,000-acre wetland area touches something, a covered water, or they say that they can regulate. And that's the situation the Lynx find themselves in. Their property is surrounded by roads and buildings. There's nothing regulable anywhere nearby, but because they're lumping together the Lynx property with all of these other alleged wetlands in the area, they can continue. They're claiming that they can regulate. So it really is. I mean, what's old is new. You know, they're doing exactly what they've been doing for 50 years. They're refusing to back down, and we're having to continue suing them and fighting with them just for them to implement a Supreme Court decision.
So, it's a question I was going to ask later, but it makes sense now. Let's see, you have a wetland, and some of it you can kind of tell where the water ends and the wetlands begins or whatever. But in other parts, you can't. So let's just say something, one part of a wetland would be jurisdictional, so it would be a WOTUS. But most of it overwhelmingly would not be. The concern would be that the agencies will simply say, well, because this one little teeny part is jurisdictional, we're going to claim that this whole huge area is jurisdictional. Is that kind of what's happening here in this instance? And also, I see that being an issue potentially in this rule. So I really think it's important that be addressed.
Yes, that is an issue. That has been a primary mode of abuse post-Sackett, is the agency's unwillingness or inability to disaggregate wetlands from jurisdictional wetlands. And what I mean by that is there's wetlands all over the country, right? Millions and millions of acres of them. Not all of them are regulated by the federal government, but they meet the sort of scientific ecological definition of what a wetland is. Now, EPA and the Army Corps are involved in the process of determining what is or isn't a wetland. So the very first thing that happens when they assert authority is they do a wetlands delineation, a pursuant called the 1987 Wetlands Manual. That's kind of beside the point. But the key being, there's a regulatory definition of wetland in the Code of Federal Regulations. And the agencies are able and consultants are able to delineate what meets this definition. And the definition deals with wetlands vegetation, you know, hydrophytic vegetation, certain classes of soils. So you can delineate the wetlands. Now, what Sackett was crystal clear about is just because something is a wetland, just because it has hydrophytic vegetation, wetland soils, general dampness. Sure, it's a wetland. That doesn't necessarily mean the federal government can regulate it. So the real key, I think one of the most important things, just at least based on what I'm seeing on the ground post-Sackett, is in this rule, the agencies need to make clear how they're disaggregating Sackett wetlands to which they have authority from the broader class of just wetlands as a general scientific or ecological concept. And that's the problem here. They haven't been able to do that. The bureaucrats in these agencies are so dead set on regulating everything that they'll do precisely what they did in the Lynx case. They'll say, well, everything's a wetland. All of these areas are wetlands, you know, pursuant to the scientific definition of what a wetland is. And because, you know, the first, you know, couple of inches directly landward of a covered water, we could regulate. Well, we can lump it all in together, notwithstanding the fact that there's a road, there's a berm, there's a row of houses blocking the remaining area of the wetland. So that's a key takeaway.
I think that in any rule, I think the administration really needs to anticipate that these agencies in the future will try to figure out every possible loophole possible, and they need to think about how to close all these loopholes so that doesn't happen again. Yeah, so that's something I think is important. So, Charles, one of the some of the key language that's discussed in Sackett, them, the court citing Rapanos, the plurality opinion, and you brought this up, is just that jurisdictional waters are only those relatively permanent, standing, or continuously flowing bodies of water forming geographical features that are described in ordinary parlance as streams, oceans, rivers, and lakes. There's a lot of components to this, relatively permanent, standing or continuously flowing bodies of water, and then forming blah, 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 and then ordinary parlance language that I just talked about. This is really important language. Can you just kind of explain why you think this is important and what you take out of that?
Yes. So as you know, there are various components to this definition of what is a water. But the thing to key in on is the Supreme Court looked at the definition of navigable waters in the Clean Water Act, and they said, well, waters. So the key is in the Clean Water Act, it deals with the regulation of waters. So what the Supreme Court really keyed in on is that in order for something to be regulated, it has to be a water. Now, what is a water? When we interpret a statute, we typically look at the ordinary meaning, ordinary public meaning of the thing to be regulated. So Supreme Court was really, really clear that the operative term here is waters. You can only regulate waters. And what is a water? They looked at the definition of waters in the dictionary. This was in the Rapanos case. And it said stream, ocean, river, lake, or the like. The bottom line being, and this is what the Supreme Court made clear in Sackett, is it has to be something that you or I could look at and say, that's a water. I know that's a water, and I know the federal government may have an interest in regulating that. So that's really the key language here, is that ordinary parlance provision of what the Supreme Court set forth there. It has to be something that in the ordinary person, ordinary language would call a water. It can't be some tiny little ditch or a little depression in the land somewhere and say, well, we think that's a water. No, it has to be something that you or I would look at in ordinary parlance and describe as a water. So that's really the key takeaway. So whatever definition they use for regulating waters, so streams, oceans, rivers, lakes, or the like, it has to make clear that this is a common or ordinary parlance test. It's a common sense test. That's the first most important thing. Second most important thing is that, what is a water? A water is defined by the ordinary presence of water. So at the very least, there must be water in the water for it to be a water for most of the year, right? It can't be dry for 11 months out of the year, just look like ordinary land, and they can regulate it as a water. So that's the second key takeaway, is that a necessary precondition for them to regulate is that there must be the ordinary presence of water in the feature they're seeking to regulate. But really important sort of footnote to that is that that condition is necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? So it's necessary for there to be water in the water, but in order for them to regulate, we have to go back to this common ordinary parlance test, right? This is the sufficient portion of the test. Not only must it have water, but it has to be a water, something that you and I would look at and describe as a water, geographical features such as streams, oceans, rivers, lakes, or the like. So those are two really important components. The ordinary presence of water throughout the year and the fact that an ordinary person could look at it and say, well, that might be regulated under the Clean Water Act. I don't have to go out and hire a consultant to give me an answer on that question.
So I think that any time, if the agencies are thinking, oh, you can have aerial photography, or we need fancy software to figure these things out, I think once they've done that, they've gone off the rails, and that they need to revisit how they're figuring out how to define what waters are covered. Because if it requires that, you probably are not in the ordinary parlance context.
Yes, if you're requiring the use of remote sensing tools and things that you might only find in a university or scientific lab in order to determine that something is regulated, then I think at that point you've strayed pretty far from ordinary parlance.
So a frequent question is, will ephemeral waters, should they be covered, and should intermittent waters be covered? How would you address that?
No, neither should be covered, because neither is marked by the ordinary presence of water. And if something's intermittent or ephemeral, I don't think you or I would call it a water. Now, that's a sort of top-line response. I'll unpack that a little bit. So for many, many years, the agencies created these artificial distinctions between so-called ephemeral waters, intermittent waters, and perennial waters. And right, you know what those words mean, but if something's ephemeral, there's only water in it every now and again, maybe in response to rainfall. If something's intermittent, there's not going to be water there all the time, but more often than in an ephemeral water. And then, of course, perennial waters flow throughout the year. So they created these artificial distinctions that have no real basis in the text of the statute. And they said, well, we can regulate ephemerals sometimes, we can regulate intermittents most of the time, and we can regulate perennials all of the time. Now, and they had various ways, you know, different presidential administrations came and went, and they had sort of different methodologies for classifying and determining regulation over these features. Sackett made crystal clear that these distinctions are no longer relevant. A water to be regulated must be a relatively permanent, continuously flowing body of water, such as a stream, ocean, river, lake, or the like. This makes no allowance whatsoever for the regulation of ephemeral or intermittent waters. They can only regulate perennially flowing waters that perennially flow throughout the year. Sackett made that crystal clear. So I would be very, very wary of the agencies perpetuating this artificial distinction that has no basis in the statute or in the Sackett decision, and it opens a door for a lot of additional regulation. Now, there are some trickier questions here, right? In the Rapanos plurality opinion, there was some reference to seasonality, right? So certain perennially flowing bodies of water, relatively permanent bodies of water, well, if there's extraordinary drought conditions in the area where that's located, they might dry up, you know, maybe once every few years, maybe once a year if the conditions are right. But that's a different question from whether they can regulate. So there's some allowance, you know, maybe if something dries up every 10, 15 years in response to drought conditions, that doesn't totally remove it from federal authority. But what is clear is that anything you would classify as intermittent or ephemeral cannot be regulated as a relatively permanent, continuously flowing body of water. That's, I mean, a pretty simple takeaway from the Sackett decision.
So I want to stress, I think it's important that the Sackett case, I mean, basically, it's very kind of supports, embraces the Rapanos plurality opinion. I think it's important, I think, to understand that. And then Rapanos plurality, they make it pretty clear. When they're talking about waters in the United States, they say the phrase does not include channels through which water flows intermittently or ephemerally, or channels that periodically provide drainage for rainfall. I mean, to me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, pretty clear that the intermittent and ephemeral waters are not covered.
It doesn't get any more clear than that. Justice Scalia, in again, important to note, that decision, his plurality opinion in that case, was adopted as the test in Sackett. It doesn't really get any more clear than that. He said no regulation of intermittent or ephemerally flowing features. Now, I mean, so just per se, if those two words find their way into the regulatory definition, well, we automatically have an unlawful rule. It's as simple as that. The Supreme Court said no. Now, if you read on a little bit in that opinion, Justice Scalia does acknowledge the closer question, the question of seasonality, right? This question of, well, what happens if something dries up, you know, in response to drought conditions once every few years? Is it or isn't regulated? And he said, maybe. It depends on the circumstances. But there is a touchstone in a footnote where he discusses this closer question that the agencies can probably at least get a clue about what they can and cannot regulate from, is that the example he provides of a quote-unquote seasonal river that might dry up occasionally that can still be regulated is a 290-day flowing river. So it's pretty clear, sure, Scalia allowed, you know, there's some, you know, room for movement on the margins here. Intermittence, ephemeral is definitely not covered. Seasonality, a closer question. There's some wiggle room for the agencies here. But, I mean, the example he gave was 290 days, right, a majority of the year. So it can't be just, well, it flows. And this is, you know, I've had cases involving this where they say something is seasonal because it flows in response to rainfall for a week in during the wet season. I mean, that's not a 290-day flowing river. So, I mean, that's an illustrative example that Justice Scalia provided, but I think it's something that the agencies could find useful in determining what they can and cannot regulate in those more marginal cases.
Yeah, and he didn't just come up with 290 days for the heck of it. I mean, or just use that. I mean, one of the key points is that at 290 days, you're dealing with a relatively permanent water. You're dealing with ordinary presence of water. So it still has to be, even if you're dealing with these seasonal waters, it still needs to meet this other requirement.
That's correct.
Permanent, ordinary parlance. I mean, my concern, I don't know what's going to happen, we'll see, is that the seasonal, instead of it being 290-day flowing water, they'll take the, let me do my math, 90-day. Mm-hmm. So it'll be 3 months. It's like, no, you can't do that because that's not consistent with the whole concept of relatively permanent.
That's right. The sort of exception swallows the rule at that point. And I think that's what you've got to underscore here is what Justice Scalia was emphasizing there were extraordinary circumstances, right? So the default is the thing flows all the time, but in certain circumstances, it might dry up due to extraordinary circumstances, at which point it's not completely taken out of federal regulation. The agencies have historically, and I'm concerned they may continue to do this, flipped that to say, no, the extraordinary circumstance is sort of irrelevant just because it's sort of seasonal. It flows for a short time every year consistently, therefore we can regulate it. But that's really not what Justice Scalia was talking about at all.
So real quick, Charles, what about ditches? Are they, should they be considered jurisdictional? Are they WOTUS?
In most circumstances, no. The vast majority of the time, a ditch cannot be regulated because would you or I look at a ditch and call it a river? Probably not. Now, there might be certain circumstances where it's particularly large. You might be able to float a boat on it, maybe by the letter of the engineering code. It's a quote-unquote ditch. But you and I might still look at it and say, hey, that looks like a continuously flowing body of water, like a stream, ocean, river, the like. Could right. regulate it there. But in the vast majority of circumstances, ordinary agricultural irrigation ditches, things of that nature, no ordinary person would consider that something that is a water geographical feature that the federal government has an interest in regulating. So prior rules have set forth ditch exemptions or exceptions from the definition, but they've got to be very clear that. So maybe they'll do that this time. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with the text of the proposed rule. That's often a good thing to do, to just make sure it's really crystal clear that a farmer's ordinary irrigation ditch isn't regulated. But the bottom line is this thing isn't going to be regulated 99% of the time anyway, because it's not what one would call an ordinary parlance, a stream, ocean, river, lake, or the like.
I would hope that some along the lines of, you know, a ditch is regulated to the extent that it meets the definition of relatively permanent water. Like, that's kind of what you're dealing with.
That's what needs to be made clear.
Any special category they want to come up with, which I hope it also come up, all these categories, but really, when all of a sudden they're done, you keep coming back to that definition, and that's what I think is important for them to, hopefully that they'll remember and apply.
That's the key. That, again, goes to the mistake the agencies have made in the past, is that thinking there are these sort of obscure categories of water that they can regulate in and of themselves. So they had a heading for wetlands, they had a heading for ditches, and the assumption was these are sort of presumptively regulated. No, these things are only regulated to the extent that they meet the bottom line test in SACCET. And in the vast majority of instances, that means they're not going to be regulated.
Charles, let's take a step back. There's going to be, this may come as a shock, but there's going to be criticism of any WOTUS rule. And some are going to claim that the agencies, the EPA and Corps, are somehow threatening clean water or whatever, you know, they claim. Would this be a fair criticism of the agencies when, you know, the rule is somehow narrower than some people would like in terms of the definition of WOTUS is narrower than it has been in the past or whatever?
No, this is not a fair criticism for a couple of reasons. The first is a sort of purely legal reason, right? Congress passed the Clean Water Act in 1972. When it passed the Clean Water Act, it set forth clearly through its definition what can and cannot be regulated. There was confusion or fighting over that for many, many years. And then SACCET said, no, this is what Congress intended in 1972. This is the standard for federal regulation. So the way I see it, the agencies here aren't really even involved in a policy-making decision. People want to criticize them as bad policy or criticize them on policy grounds. But this is not a policy decision. This is non-discretionary. They're setting forth a rule interpreting a statutory provision in accordance with what the Supreme Court has said what that statutory provision means. Their hands are essentially tied. They have no discretion here. They have to. That's how our separation of powers works. They have to implement the judiciary's interpretation of a statute. It's non-discretionary decision-making. The second point on this, and this is broader, goes beyond that kind of legal question, is more on policy grounds. When Congress passed the Clean Water Act in 1972, it was very, very clear, as we all know, that land use authority lies with the states. The states have primary authority over land and water use. That is how our constitutional order is set up. It's a residuary power of the states to regulate land use. And states are better at doing that because they're closer to the ground. State legislature or state administrators have a much better idea when it comes to balancing environmental goals versus development on the ground, as opposed to some bureaucrats in faraway Washington, D.C. that, as you noted, are looking at LIDAR data or something like that. So that's the key. And Congress explicitly set that forth in the body of the Clean Water Act. In the purpose section, it made clear the primary authority over land and water use still resides with the state. So I say all this to make the point that if the federal government narrows its definition of what it can and cannot regulate in accordance with the Clean Water Act, that doesn't mean the automatic end to the protection of wetlands and water features, because the states themselves have comprehensive regulatory regimes that balance environmental protection against development. Every state has independent protections for wetlands. So just because the federal government or the agencies in this circumstance set forth a narrow rule, that doesn't mean that, you know, sort of doomsday scenario of unmitigated pollution begins tomorrow. That's really, really important to note. Authority over this lies with the states, and the federal government is simply stepping aside and returning that power to the states as the framers of our Constitution intended and as the drafters of the Clean Water Act clearly intended.
That's great. It's important points. So as we close out, are there some additional points you'd like to make or anything that you think is really important to stress to ensure that any proposed rule is consistent with SACCET?
Yes, let me very quickly make 3 points or underscore points I made previously. The first is when it comes to regulating covered quote-unquote waters. Again, for something to be regulated, it has to be something that you or I would look at and describe in ordinary parlance as a stream, ocean, river, lake, or the like. It has to be relatively permanent and has to be continuously flowing. It must be marked by the ordinary presence of water, but the ordinary presence of water is not sufficient for regulation. It's merely a necessary precondition. Again, has to be something in common parlance that you or I would describe as a stream, ocean, river, lake, or the like. When it comes to wetlands, what needs to be made abundantly clear is that the agencies do not have inherent authority to regulate wetlands. They may only regulate wetlands incidentally to the regulation of true waters. What that means is the wetland must have a continuous surface water connection and it must be indistinguishable from the covered water. Again, something that you or I could look at and say that wetland is truly a part of the covered water. Now, I'll add one final point to that. Since SACCET was issued, and again earlier this year, the agency seemed to have adopted a test of quote-unquote abutment. They're saying something meets the SACCET indistinguishability test, a wetland meets a SACCET indistinguishability test if it merely physically abuts a covered water, such that it's very close by. Now, abutment is simply not the test. Physical abutment is an unlawful test under the Clean Water Act and the SACCET decision because it ignores the surface water and indistinguishability requirements. Now, if something physically abuts a water and it also has a continuous surface water connection and is indistinguishable, then sure, they can regulate it. But emphasizing this issue of abutment, which has no discernible basis in the SACCET decision, is going to run them off the rails pretty quickly. And on that point, I'll make one final note. This physical abutment theory or test, it's already been rejected by a district court in the Southern District of Florida. On summary judgment, final judgment was entered against the federal government late last year in a decision called United States versus Shafi, where the EPA had been attempting to assert authority on the theory that wetlands abutted a water. The Southern District of Florida unambiguously said, no, you cannot do that, and the federal government didn't appeal. So that's on the books, and the agencies need to be really, really clear that physical abutment is not sufficient for regulation.
Charles, thank you so much. It's been a great discussion. I've definitely learned a lot, and I want to thank the Federal Society for organizing this podcast, and I want to thank, of course, all of you for listening in. I hope you found the discussion as helpful as I did, and Charles' expertise and insight. Thanks again.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.